sure Bruce is. I know Bruce is, I'm sure Sam's in my DM.
Yep.
So you can be, you're stuck.
Well, I'm gonna get started, knowing full well that once we get really into the good stuff, we're going to be, more people will come in and go, what are you talking about today? So then I'll let you explain what it's all about. I'm David Gordon, and I've written 19 books, mostly on the odd aspects of nature. Have any of you been to my previous talks this week?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. Then you know I've also written about cockroaches and Bigfoot and, well, slugs and snails is the one we're really going to talk about. I really like talking about stuff that hasn't already been covered to death. I mean, we already know that bald eagles are wonderful, right? They're a nation symbol. So I'm not going to, I did write a book about bald eagles, but I don't find that as interesting as some of these weirder things. And this picture here is actually an exaggeration postcard. This is a gooey duck clam. I know it looks like geoduck in print, but it's actually pronounced gooey duck. And that comes from the Native American word, which was gueduck, and means to dig deep. And the reason they get that great name is because they actually have a neck that's 3 feet long. That's a big neck. And sticks up out of the sand just a little bit. So they're down 3 feet in the sand. If you go out to a coastal area in Washington, you might be able to find one. You have to dig 3 feet in the sand. Hard to do. It keeps filling in the hole. It's a lot of work. Some people actually use what they call a gooey duck gun. I love this term. It's a garbage can with the bottom taken out of it. They kind of push that down, dig out the sand, push it down a little further, and that's how they can get down 3 feet. So, like I said, this is an exaggeration card. I like it so much because it kind of shows in one picture sort of our ambivalence about some of these invertebrates, that we like to eat them, but we don't like them themselves. So, which is kind of what's going on here. Gooey ducks sell for $15 a pound overseas. And when you think that one might be 10 pounds, that's a lot of money to pay for a clam, right? Yeah.
Did you ever actually eat gooey duck yourself?
I have. You can get it.
It's kind of like a really stinky flip flop.
Yeah, I was going to say, or a little piece of inner tube.
Yeah, right.
It has to be cut very thin and scored. But you can also make gooey duck fritters and all that. Well, the other reason I like showing this picture is because the Washington State, the Pacific Northwest, it's kind of like Texas for invertebrates. Everything big is here. And like we have the biggest octopus species, we have the world's fastest starfish, we have the biggest burrowing clam. We have a lot of those really great boats. I moved here from Illinois in 1981 to work at a public aquarium. And I was all wrapped up in fish at that time. I thought fish were really cool. Well, when I moved to Washington, I went, this is like the land of boring fish. They're brown and silver. You know, forget these coral reef, gaudy coral reef fish. These are kind of boring by comparison. But the invertebrates were amazing. And then I was really glad that I had taken an invertebrate class in college because I started paying a lot more attention to all these giant sea stars and sea anemones and all that cool stuff. This is the book we're basically drawing material from today. It's my little infomercial. They do have copies of in the store, a few copies of this book, Secret World of Slugs and Snails. The subtitle, Life in the Very Slow Lane. And the nice part about this book for me, aside from the fact that I got to really indulge my interest in something like researching this for years, I also got to work with my wife, Karen, who's teaching art classes here, and she did all the illustrations for it. So when you see black and white drawings in, as part of these slides, most of them are done by Karen. And she told me at one point, this is like portrait painting. Each one of these slugs is different. You know, so she had to really pay a lot of attention. She did a nice job of that, I think. Well, the whole thrust of life in the slow lane and why I like it so much. Slugs and snails, you know, we like to pride ourselves as being the kind of the kingpins. Whenever you see a family tree of nature, who's at the top? That would be us, people, right? Because, duh, we drew the tree. Yeah. So we have all this pride in what we do and what makes us so special. And those things include a big brain, you know, opposable thumbs that can allow us to grip tools, being able to walk upright on our 2 feet, warm-bloodedness, all that stuff. Well, slugs and snails don't have any of that. Instead of a big brain, they have 6 main nerve cells. That's their big brain, a little ring of nerve cells. They don't have opposable thumbs. They don't even have hands or arms or legs, for that matter. No limbs. They get by really well by crawling around on their bellies, which is they do. They actually have ripples of muscle that move them forward, and they literally surf on a layer of slime. That's how they get around. They're not warm-blooded. They're cold-blooded. They don't have a great... The other one we like to pride ourselves on is maternal and paternal investment, you know, raising our young. Well, these guys lay eggs and good luck eggs. They move on. Nonetheless, they've been around for millions and millions of years. They predate even our friends, the cockroaches. So we're talking maybe 400 million years. It's hard to find fossils of slugs, but they do find fossils of snails. So all of those reasons, I kind of go, you know, we like to think we've got it all worked out, but they obviously had it worked out really well for themselves long before humankind evolved and started doing its thing on the planet. And the other thing, of course, is they do everything slowly. You don't ever see a slug do anything fast. Slowly and silently. In fact, the only time you hear the noise from a slug or a snail is when it's eating. If you're in a really quiet room, you can hear their jaws crunching. That's the only sound that they make. So all of those, for all those reasons, we're almost dealing with extraterrestrials here. Except, of course, 90% of the life on our planet is invertebrate life, isn't it? We're the vertebrates, right? We have backbones. That's what that means. Animals with backbones. Because we're calling the shots again, we call 90% of the world the animals that don't have backbones. It's kind of human-centric there. I also, very early on, wanted to establish that the book itself is more than a natural history. There's a lot of human history. I mentioned during the time we were talking about cockroaches that what I really love and what I'm fascinated with is the way people and animals interact. So there's a lot of poems in here. There's mentions of songs. We had someone singing the banana slug song earlier, as maybe some of you heard that. There's a lot of human connections between these critters and ourselves. And this is a gentleman who probably should become famous. I love this connection because this is Richard Mead. He was an 18th century pharmacist. And you know, the pharmacies of the day were pretty bizarre. He invented this product called snail water. Don't you all want to run out and get some? Delicious. But at the time, in the 1700s, people were really worried about the disease consumption. It was almost like the AIDS of the 18th century. And you know, all three of the Bronte sisters died of consumption. It's what we now call tuberculosis. People felt that by eating snails, that's part of the reason the French got so into it, by eating snails, you could ward off this consumption. And I'm going to read to you, because I always feel like you should read from one's books. I'm going to read to you Richard Mead's recipe for snail water, because I think this should be set to music. It would be really good. I could just hear it like in The Sound of Music or something. And here's his recipe for making snail water, which is what they gave the patients in hospitals in that day. Here, drink some of this. You'll feel a lot better. Take garden snails, cleansed and bruised. 6 gallons. That's a lot of garden snails. Now what else? Earthworms, washed and bruised. 3 gallons. You know, kind of lightly bruised. Not mashed, just bruised. Of common wormwood, ground ivy, and cardus, I think that's cardamom, each 1.5 pounds. Pennyroyal, juniper berries, fennel seeds, anise seeds, each 0.5 pounds. Cloves and cubebs bruised, each 3 ounces. Spirit of wine and spring water of each 8 gallons. So you're starting out with 6 gallons of snails, but now you're getting a lot of water in there too. Digest them together for the space of 24 hours, and then draw it off in a common alembic. That's kind of like a distillery. So if you want to make this recipe at home and try it out yourself, it's in the book. Okay? All right. We're talking about land slugs and snails here. There are lots of slugs and snails in the ocean. And I just love this quote. Land snails used to live in the ocean, but moved ashore. Since nobody told them otherwise, they expected the land to be as wet as the water. We all make mistakes. That's from Will Cuppy, who wrote a great book called How to Become Extinct. And this is kind of a, well, you'd never see this in nature. This is a whole sort of, it's almost a 19th century approach to showing the slug diversity on the West Coast. There are lots of different kinds of slugs. This is one of Karen's illustrations. And my joke is, I think this would make a great shower curtain, if they ever want to make a shower curtain. So in this mix here, these are all native and non-native species mixed together. How many of you are gardeners? And how many of you have had to battle with slugs or snails? You know they're a force to be reckoned with, not easy to get rid of. That's because they're really well adapted to life in kind of a wet, wet environment on land. They're all air breathers. They actually have, instead of having gills like the marine snails, the conchs and the cowries and all that, instead of having gills, they actually have a lung. But they only have one. We like to think that everything is symmetrical, right hand, left hand. These only have one lung. You can kind of see it down here on this guy right here. It's a little hole. If you watch really carefully on the slug as it's traveling around, you can see that hole open and close. The fancy word for this, great for Scrabble games, is a pneumostone. And it opens to a lung. So they actually are lunged animals. The fancy word for all the slugs and snails we're talking about is they're called pulmonates because they're air breathing with lungs. And these lungs aren't just little holes into the body. They're actually, what they say, highly vascularized. They're complicated. They're about as complicated as a lung that you'd find in a newt or a salamander. So for a little lowly slug, that's not a bad thing. I was starting to say the slugs that we and snails that we do battle with in our gardens, for the most part, are non-native. They've actually been brought here from other places. Accidentally, maybe on plants way back when. We do this a lot. In fact, the earthworms that we see, night crawlers, those really big worms that we like to go fishing with, are from Africa. They probably came in the earliest ships to the New World. You know, along with the pilgrims, they had a lot of plant material in the holds of those ships. And so they could plant that here. And in the soil and in on the plants themselves, there were all sorts of things, hitchhikers, that became really well established. They left all their enemies behind in the old country. And in the case of slugs and snails, they actually evolved in the same time and the same environment that most of our garden crops came from. You know, broccoli is not native to North America. It was brought here from Eurasia. And a non-native snail or slug knows what broccoli looks like and where to find it. Or worse yet, cilantro. I've bought cilantro starts, left them out on the porch, and voila, they're gone the next day. So those animals actually are adapted to live in our gardens, and they've done a really great job of this. In this picture here, there's one way up in the top, the upper right corner. A little hard to see the way these animals change their shape. This one's all humped up, but can also stretch out just like the one in the bottom. And this is called the chocolate arion. They also call them European black slugs. And I'd say 80% of the time when people, gardeners, are dealing with slugs, it's that guy. Directly below it, there's one with all these spots. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in a little bit, called a giant garden slug, or they also call them leopard slugs because they have spots all over them. Those are also not native to North America. But some of these others, this banana slug, that's the one down at the bottom, the big guy, they can actually grow to be about 10 inches in length and weigh a quarter of a pound. I'll tell you a ridiculous story about banana slugs. I was on a talk radio show once. And people were calling in. I just love this. And they said they were out camping on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington with some visitors from Wisconsin. So they all went out and they set their camp and were getting relaxed. And one of the people decided they needed to go take a leak. So they walked out into the woods and they came running back. They had just found a deer embryo. It's a deer embryo, it's a deer embryo. Well, no, it wasn't. It was a banana slug. But you know, those horns on there. Those horns, by the way, are actually eye stalks. We could call them tentacles, but they're optic stalks, basically. There are little eyes on there. And that was enough to fool this person, seeing this big yellow thing covered in slime with those big horns. It was a deer. Okay, my favorite story, I think. All right. These are all the native and non-native snails, and also, again, a wonderful shower curtain design. And also, you would not find all of these in one spot. And we kind of designed some of the illustrations for this book off of those 1800s nature books, where they have the animals of Africa, that kind of thing. So I like working with Karen on getting all these illustrations just right, even though they're scientifically inaccurate in terms of the setting. The one on the very corner, the bottom left corner, that's called a brown garden snail, Helix aspersa. And it's also one of two different species that would be called escargot snails. People eat those. So if you have these in your backyard and you're not using garden chemicals to kill them, you can harvest them, purge them, and then prepare them. I have a little section in the book on grow your own escargot. I don't think we find too many of these animals up here around Holden Village because it's just too cold, and the wintertime is a great deterrent for slugs and snails. But some of them can get by. I'm not going to say there aren't snails here, because I bet if you actually looked at some of the rockery work, you would find a few snails that can get by. I was talking about how these, a lot of the pesky ones are the ones that were brought in here, and there's a great story that people seem to think is true, that the escargot snails were brought into North America by a vineyard owner in San Jose, California, in the 1800s. He is French, and he went, what this country needs is a good escargot snail. And I'm sure they are coming in on his vine stock. So rather than getting rid of them, he started cultivating them. He became like the Johnny Appleseed of snails. And he started spreading them all over the place. So in Los Angeles, he didn't want to lose them all if one crop went bad. So he put them in San Francisco and in Los Angeles. And it's pretty much determined now that our big woes fighting these guys began with this Frenchman, Mr. Delmas, who introduced them in the 1800s. The idea of snails escaping sounds really weird. Like, what did they do, run across the Rockies to get to the They didn't, but they traveled in plant material, and that's pretty much how they go. When they did a survey in Hawaii not too long ago of nurseries, they found that a lot of the nurseries, I can't remember the exact number, but let's say 70% of nursery surveyed had non-native slugs and snails in their plant material. And you know, when you're in an island like Hawaii and you introduce something that wasn't there before, you have really serious ramifications. They have serious issues with non-native snails being introduced into the United States, as well as a really active part of our U.S. Customs and Department of Agriculture programs. And not too long ago, there were some non-native snails that were coming in to the United States through shipments of tiles from Mexico. They'd store the tiles outdoors. The snails would get in between the individual tiles in the pallets. They'd come in on a ship. And they actually had to do a quarantine of about, 10 square miles around the port of Tacoma, Washington, to just make sure they could get rid of these snails before they spread too far. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Slugs and snails are amazing animals because I mentioned before they have 6 nerve cells that call the shots that in the equivalent of our brain. But they have very complex behaviors. And like I said, they do everything slowly. So you have to have a lot of patience if you're going to do field work on slugs and snails to watch that complex behavior. This is a picture. Our publisher actually went, oh, this is way too fanciful. But it's actually based on photographs. These are 2 of those escargot snails about to mate. And when they get together, they have a very elaborate courtship. There's a wonderful movie called Microcosmos. It's a French movie that has a close-up, a lot of close-ups of insects and other animals. And there's a scene of two snails mating with opera music behind it. It's moving. Well, these guys are getting down to the act of intercourse, but with foreplay, and when they actually get together, they put the souls, that's what you call that, their bellies, together, and they kiss. That's a pretty complicated little ritual there. This goes on for hours. Like I said, they're not in a hurry. I'm always thinking of that song, I need a lover with a slow hand. That's what they do. They're very intelligent. And I have to tell you, here's a story that's true from my own experience. I was actually working with a film crew once. They wanted to get really good video footage of banana slugs. And they put a large camera, this is back when you had to use large video cameras, on a picnic table. And we put the banana slug at the other end. And you could actually see this aha moment when the banana slug went, oh, look, there's a cave over there, and started crawling towards the lens. Well, when it got to the lens and realized there's glass in front of it, then it kind of looked to the left, looked to the right. This is fascinating to watch. And then eventually it decided to crawl over and start going to the viewfinder. Well, there's another cave over there. It was like problem solving. And I never see that with insects. If you have the porch light on and the screen door, you know, they keep banging against the screen, you kind of go over and say, go use the door on the side. Come on, you guys. Because they just are hardwired. They're like robotic. Whereas these animals do seem to have a higher degree of problem solving. It's not just me. Charles Darwin wrote about this as well in one of his books. So, like I said, the courtship ritual is very ornate, very elaborate, ends with lots of little snails and slugs. And the other thing that gets complex and elaborate is, of course, is these land slugs and snails are hermaphrodites. They have both male and female parts in one animal. They have the war of the sexes going on inside themselves. And when they do mate, there's a lot of exchange of genetic material, eggs and sperm, in both directions. So it's a two-way swap. Of course, slugs and snails, being clever, have figured out ways of having trade monopolies and imbalances. And they have all sorts of ways for making sure that their eggs are the first to get going, or that it's only a one-way trade. There's a lot of trickery in their mating, believe it or not. I won't get into that today. This is, after all, Olden Village. But some good stories. Catch me at lunch, and I'll tell you some hair-raising stories. The one I will tell you, because I just think this is fascinating.
I need a big tip.
Yeah, I knew that would get you. There's a device that these snails have called a copulatory dart. It's one little dart that's very small. It's like a little splinter, if you will, made out of calcium. They keep it in a special sheath, and when they get together like this, it's like the first one to shoot it. It's like we were talking earlier about the Westerns in the Bible study. Draw! And they both shoot these darts and into the other one. And for years, people could not figure out why this was. You can actually pick up a snail at the wrong time and get shot yourself and feel that, okay? So a professor I talked to actually hired a graduate student to research this. He determined that, you know, our myth of Cupid and the arrow may have come from snails. That was his theory. So he hired a graduate student to go through all of the archives to look at all the pottery and the murals and designs of Venus and Cupid to see if he could find snails in any of them. Nope, sorry, he didn't. But it didn't deter him from holding this theory. Because it turns out that on that dart, the copulatory dart, there are chemicals, hormones, that actually make the one who got shot more receptive to their sperm. It kind of opens them up a little bit more. So now you have that trade monopoly going. The babies are going to look a lot more like the one who shot first, rather than the one who got shot. I saw a newspaper headline. They were talking in Canada, of course. They had to use a hockey analogy. They were talking about the study, and the headline said, "He shoots, she scores." Okay. More sex talk. If you can't talk about slug sex, what can you talk about? These are two of those so-called leopard slugs hanging upside down by a mucus thread, and that's how they mate. It's like the Cirque du Soleil of slug sex. That big blobby thing down on the bottom, that's actually their genitalia. And it's all kind of mashed up together there because it's a two-way street. Imagine if you drove your car to the filling station and you had to put the hose into the gas tank and then take another hose out of your car and put it into the... That's basically what's going on here. So it's pretty complicated. But they do that well in midair because, of course, they're vulnerable at a time like this. So by being suspended by mucus, that's kind of amazing. And like I said, the end result are babies, lots of them. They're usually laid in the soil. And I'm going to give you my first practical bit of advice because we are going to talk about slug and snail control. I always say the book itself spends the first two-thirds talking about how fascinating these animals are and the last third, how to get rid of them. So now you know how wonderful they are. Here's how to get rid of them. If you go out in the fall, if you have problems with slugs and snails in your garden, you go out in the fall and you rake up that first inch, just kind of disturb it up, you're going to start uncovering these nests and exposing them to the air, and birds love to eat those eggs, and other animals, insects do as well. So that's a great control measure. Just go out there and perturb them. The eggs themselves actually have hard shells like chicken eggs. They're sometimes like the banana slug, as you can imagine, they're quite large. They're actually about the size of a tapioca grain. Pretty distinctive. And they're usually in clutches like this in the soil. Great illustration. Nice work here. Oops. Okay, here's an actual cover photo of one of those Helix aspersa, the brown garden snail. And an interesting thing about slugs and snails, they need a lot of calcium to grow, to secrete those shells. Some of these shells are quite elaborate and beautiful. I sort of go, gee, if I went to pottery class and came back with something, I'd be happy if it was like that. And, you know, here's this quote, lowly animal making these beautiful shells. But they have a gland that's called the mantle. On slugs, you can see it actually looks like a saddle. Just think of slugs as snails without shells, and then that'll help a lot. But in order to secrete all that calcium to make a shell, you need a lot of calcium in your diet. If you think this is weird, by the way, you know, we basically secrete calcium from little glands when we make teeth as little kids. That's all coming from little glands, the tooth buds, on which the calcium grows. We need a lot of calcium ourselves. In areas of the world where there's not a lot of calcium in the soil, and that would include the Northwest, anywhere there's a lot of volcanic activity, the soil is kind of poor in calcium. If you're growing vegetables here, you wind up putting bone meal into the soil to build up the calcium. It's hard for these animals to create the shells. It's actually one of the advantages of being a slug. You don't have to worry about that. But when you pick up one of these animals here in the Northwest, their shells are very flimsy. You can actually kind of crack them, which is in effect going to kill the snail over a long period of time, just by lifting it up with your fingers. It's not a very thick shell compared to the same animals in France, for example. Here's the other one we have all over the place. This one, Sepia nemoralis is its scientific name. They also call it a grove snail because in some places, Southern California, for example, these animals get into the citrus groves, lemons and oranges, and eat all the leaves off the trees. What do you think the solution to that would be? Well, let's introduce some snails that eat these snails. That's what they did. They started getting snails that were, I don't know, predatory snails and putting them out in the gardens. Well, unfortunately, those predators don't know the difference between the natives that belong there and the non-natives that are pests. And it wasn't a great idea. It did work, but it also knocked out a lot of the native species in Southern California. Now you have to have special permits to use those snails. You can still buy them in bulk, but you have to have a special permit to do that. The other thing that's really interesting about these snails is this banded pattern is it's variable, that's what I meant to say. It changes a lot, and sometimes you find the same snail without bands, sometimes the bands are really distinctive. Sometimes there's orange in there and all sorts of different patterns, which is kind of confusing if you're just identifying the snails by the shell patterns. There was an experiment that's conducted online. I think the Royal British Museum sponsored this. Yeah, as part of Darwin's, what was that, the bicentennial? 150 years, I don't remember. They put up this website, and people would go and identify what the sepia snails looked like where they lived. And we're talking worldwide. You know, click on the one that most resembles yours. And then they got kind of a map of where the ones were that had the bands, the ones that didn't have the bands, and so on. It also, it turned into a really valuable study because these snails are a favored food of thrushes. You know, thrushes are big birds. They're like robins or thrushes. And in Europe, they actually take these snails, they beat them against a rock to break the shell, and they eat the snail. So that's called, I love that people, scientists have a name for everything. Those are called thrush anvils. So they discovered that the bands are camouflage. They may not look at in this picture, but it helps the snails to blend in. So if there are lots of thrushes in an area, you find lots of snails with really impressive bands. If there aren't any thrushes in the area, it doesn't really matter so much, and you find lots of snails without bands. So the same map that they're creating online is also showing you the health of thrush populations around the world. I thought that was really a great way of getting two research projects conducted with one website.
Can we ask questions or wait till the
end? Oh yeah, go ahead.
Well, I've lived here in Seattle most all my life, right? And of course, it's rampant with slugs all over the place. But it wasn't until we moved into our new house in North Seattle that we started having these snails. I thought, where did these come from? I've never seen them before. You know, they've just been in our house or someone in our neighborhood, I guess. So I didn't even think that they were from around here or someone in our house brought them by accident. I never thought of them as being, you know, are these still the French ones brought over, you think?
Well, the thing that's so interesting, you're not talking about animals that travel great distances. They're not like the humpback whale and start out in Hawaii and go to Alaska. Yeah. It takes them a really long time to go about the length of a football field. And they're saying that most populations have a radius of about a mile. So if someone introduced those snails into an area through their crops or their ornamentals, then they're all over the place. But they might not be anywhere else outside of like the mile radius of where they were introduced. So that might be the explanation. When I lived in Seattle on Capitol Hill, I had all of those sepia nemorellis, the banded snails, like crazy in our little block, partly because the people that lived in the house before us were really avid and eccentric gardeners. So they probably started our own little infestation.
Okay.
But when I moved to Port Townsend on the Olympic Peninsula, we had all of the other kinds of snails. We had the escargot snails. Oh. So, and I think part of that was also a large port of entry. So they had a lot of plant material in the holds of ships in the 1800s. Maybe that's where those came from. So I'd actually like to do a similar experiment on the website sometime, get people to report in what they're seeing where they live, just in the Seattle city limits would be really fascinating. Yeah. Okay, here I wanted to just show you an example of a native species. You know, people like to go bird watching, and they carry out their Peterson's guides, and they see, they have a life list of all the birds. Well, there's actually a book that I really like a lot called The Land Snails of British Columbia that's like the field guide to all these different kinds of slugs and snails. There are a lot of native species you wouldn't really see unless you were looking for them. So I encourage you all to start life lists of slugs and snails that you see. You know, have a master list. Go spend lots of money to go on trips to Cuba, for example, to see the land snails down there. This is called the Pacific Sideband, and it's a native species. It's very, very closely associated with the old growth forests. If you want to see one of these, don't look down on the ground, because they actually really like to hang out in the crotches of the really big big leaf maple trees. There's a lot of plant material there, mosses and all that growing there. They're eating a lot of algae that grows on those trees. And they're about 20 feet up off the ground. So how they got there, I hope they got an airlift or something, because that's a long ways to go. But that's where a lot of them are, is in higher altitudes in forests. And it really does pay off, if you're a gardener, to know which are the native species and which are the non-native species. This one is called a robust lancetooth. Kind of an elegant name. Haplotrema vancouverense. It's named after Captain Vancouver. Hey, way to go. And the reason it's nice to recognize these, we have them on our property. These are snails that will actually track down, kill, and eat other snails. So those non-natives, I always wondered, how come we don't have big holes in our hosta plants? It's probably because these guys are going out and policing and getting some of the non-native plant-eating snails. They have an exceptionally long body. They can come really far out and actually follow a snail back as it's retreating into its shell, like, lock the doors. Here comes the robust lancetooth. But they can beat them at their game by getting in that far. The reason they call them lancetooths, I think, is fascinating. Did you know that snails had teeth? Well, you do now. They actually have a thing, it's called a radula. It's like a tongue covered with teeth that serves like a file. They're actually rasping away at plant material. They have jaws that clamp down and hold the leaf in place, and then they use that radula to scrape away at food. They actually lose and gain, regrow new teeth all the time, just like sharks do. Well, the lancetooth has modified teeth that are like shaped like harpoons. I'm having a hard time talking today. Harpoons. So they can actually, when they get down in there, they use those special teeth. It's almost like a little skewer, escargot cocktail pick, to pull out the snail. So these are our friends. If you have problems with snails in your gardens, don't get rid of these. Get rid of the other ones. Moving on to the non-native slugs, here's a leopard slug again. Ooh. Yeah, boo, we don't like these. A good way to dispatch these animals, by the way, take out a Ziploc bag, throw them in the Ziploc bag, put that in the freezer. And it's kind of a humane way for dispatching them, because as the temperature gets cooler, they're cold-blooded animals. They move slower and slower and slower. They slow down. Eventually, they drift off into a deep sleep, and they never wake up. It's like a Jack London story. They basically freeze to death. But it's a painless death. Then you can take them and compost them. This doesn't work if you have teenagers in the house who are always going through the freezer looking for something to eat. It might train them, though. We don't know. A reason to get rid of these is they're very aggressive. They're territorial slugs. And this is probably my favorite image. It sounds like America's Funniest Home Videos. But they actually will chase down other slugs. That has to be fast motion photography, right, to see that. But they'll chase other slugs. And I read one time that said if you go out in the morning and you see a slug expiring on the sidewalk, it probably got a fatal bite from one of these leopard slugs. So all our native species are suffering while these are thriving. Did you have a question back there?
Yes. After you've frozen one of these babies, does the slime become less sticky, or you still can't get it off your fingers if you handle it?
You know, I'm so glad you brought up the subject of slime. That's the other thing we're going to talk about at lunch. We'll talk about slug slime and slug sex. And if everyone goes back for seconds, I'll be surprised. Slime is really fascinating stuff, and I have a whole section in my book about it's the seven wonders of snaildom. Slime is one of them. Slime, the molecules of slime are incredibly hydrophilic. They love water molecules. And one slug slime molecule can absorb something like 100 water molecules. So you get slime on your hands, and you try to wash it under the tap, guess what? Now you're 10 times or 100 times slimier than you were before. So my advice to you is to actually roll it off. Pretend it's rubber cement. You go, and get rid of it that way. Get rid of it as much as you can without using water. I found this really fascinating study that was done. The slime molecules themselves, well, if they absorb water like crazy, how come they don't blow up the cells that they're in, which have water in them, before they're even secreted? And they did a lot of really in-depth study on this. And they learned that that molecule is actually coiled up really tightly like a spring. Once it's actually secreted from the mucus-making cells, then it can absorb water and become this really big molecule. But inside there, it's really small. So someone figured out what a great delivery mechanism for cancer drugs. You know, when you want to treat cancer, you wind up putting this really toxic chemicals at a specific spot, a tumor. You don't want it distributed all over the place, so it has to be encapsulated. And the whole game is to get as much of that medicine in as small a capsule as possible. So they've actually developed a patent based on slug slime as a pattern for synthesizing cancer medicine. So I wound up writing a kid's article, "The Secrets of Slug Slime Could Someday Save Your Life." It's kind of amazing what we learn from studying nature, bioengineering. All right, back to the slug and snail gallery.
How many kinds of slime are there?
Who asked that question? That's right. Gee, how big was it? Actually, the thing that's also fascinating about slime, you could have said this, Kieran, because she knows as much about slugs and snails as I do, just from illustrating the book. Slugs and snails can produce different kinds of slime depending on what they're trying to do. If you think about it, if you're going uphill and you're producing this slippery stuff, every step forward you're going to take two steps back, right? So they can actually adjust the slipperiness and turn it into the stickiness of the slime, and which is why sometimes you'll actually see slugs or snails straight up on a wall or even on the ceiling. They can make it that sticky. They find it actually by pushing down as part of the mechanism of crawling, they can make it slimy or stickier just by adjusting the pressure there. The other fascinating thing, maybe we won't have to talk about slime over lunch, because the other fascinating thing is they put chemical scents into those slime trails that you see. They actually put little messages in there using chemicals. Another slug or snail comes along, sniffs the slime, and goes, "Oh, there's broccoli over here. You know, follow me, man." It's like they can actually send signals to each other that way. This is also documented by Charles Darwin. They also can send territorial messages, as in, "Stay out of here. This is my broccoli patch." So, don't you wish you could produce slime? Actually, we all need slime. And to tell you the truth, a lot of our own diseases, cystic fibrosis, and a lot of diseases are because we're not producing enough or too much mucus. We need mucus, otherwise we'd squeak when we walked, right? Okay. Here's my favorite, the banana slug.
Yay.
I was saying earlier, the University of California at Santa Cruz has a banana slug for its mascot. Go slugs, go. It's there, and they actually have their motto is Fiat Slug, which means let there be slugs, right? I remember reading that I think it was the president of the university really wanted the seal, because they have California sea lions and harbor seals there, to be the mascot, but the slug won out. And there are all sorts of t-shirts and posters and things with these beautiful banana slugs, which are all over that part of California. The range of these is from about the redwoods in California all the way up to southeast Alaska. And these are North America's largest slugs. Like I said before, 10 inches long, a quarter pound in weight. That's a lot of weight for an animal that doesn't have bones or anything else to bulk it up. And they live about 5 years. You can see, oh, aren't they adorable little baby banana slugs? Look just like mom and dad. And young of the year, they're only about 3 inches long, and then the big ones, which have been there for quite some time. And they come in a variety of colors. So this one's green and black, but you can also find pure yellow ones. That's where they get their name, banana slugs. Or yellow ones with black spots, which look like overly ripe bananas. And even black ones and white ones, all different colors. Someone also did some research on this. I love what people choose to study, don't you? They looked at all the different colors and they figured out that the darker colored slugs absorb heat from the sun faster. So they can get an earlier start on the day, basically. Whereas the darker colored ones don't. So in areas where it's really, excuse me, I just reversed that. The darker colored ones absorb more heat. The light colored ones don't. If you find a really cold area, like in southeast Alaska, that's where you're likely to see black banana slugs, because they need to get that extra heat. whereas the ones down in Santa Cruz are more likely to be yellow. But the really fascinating story about banana slugs, I think, is that they're little gardeners. You know, their habitat, one of their main habitats are the redwood forests of California. And they've done studies that show that these slugs go around and they eat all the plants that are competing with the redwood seedlings. They eat around the redwoods. They don't eat the redwoods themselves. I don't know if that's because they're being humanitarian. I think it's more because the redwoods don't taste good. They're basically cutting down on the competition for leaves, so they're encouraging the seedlings to grow. And of course, they also poop right around those, so they're fertilizing the soil around the redwoods. So when you see 100-foot tall redwood trees, you know they got starts, helper starts from the banana slug. Way to go, guys. I'm just going to show you some. They're not all ooh yucky. This one's a purple slug. It's called a tail dropper, and it's named a tail dropper because, like the lizards, when they're, you know, they're harassed and they have to escape from an enemy, these can actually lose a little bit of their tail, which wriggles around, looks really fascinating, and they're hoping that the animal that's harassing them could be one of those carabid or tiger beetles, a black beetle, could be a snake, could be a bird. Whatever is harassing them will be happy to just take the tail and let them continue to live and grow another tail. This one I just love because I love words, period, but it's such a strange-looking slug. This is called a warty jumping slug. Sounds like something out of Harry Potter, doesn't it? Warty jumping slug. And if you look at the mantle, that's that saddle, that part of the body that would normally, in a snail, would be producing a shell. There are lots of little dots all over there, the warts. But the jumping part comes from the fact that they can wriggle around like an inchworm and freak out predators just by their erratic behavior.
I read that they can fly. I did. I read that they can fly in one of the books you have in your library.
Well, there you go.
That they can suspend their slime and be like Tarzan.
So swinging.
Yeah.
Through the jungle. Yeah, that would make sense.
Jump and swing.
Surprisingly, the other reason I like showing the. The other reason I like showing the warty jumping slug is there are endangered slugs and snails. And we put a lot of energy into protecting the panda and the Asian rhinoceros or what have you, what we call the charismatic megafauna, the stuff that we really think is super cool because it's big and impressive. But the rate of extinction for the small stuff, insects and mollusks, the slugs and the snails, is also really rather rapid and alarming. Part of it's because of habitat loss. A lot of these animals eat very specific diets or have very specific habitat needs, and when they take out a section of forest and put in some beautiful homes, they pretty much wiped out the habitat for these animals. So don't think because we have zillions of the pest ones that everybody here is really doing great and we don't have to be concerned about keeping the biodiversity of the planet. Slugs and snails have lots of different functions. They're plant pollinators, they're garbage collectors, they break down a lot of dead material, and they're food for lots of other animals. So when they do disappear, we're missing them, whether we know it immediately or not. All right, I heard that bell, so I'm going to race through the how to get rid of them section. Don't use a leg iron trap like this one. This I got in a novelty store. I thought that was just too good. Little tiny leg iron trap. You need zillions of them for one thing. You're better off by modifying your gardening practices. We create little oases, little paradises for slugs and snails when we're gardening. We don't want just one tulip to come up. We want whole beds of tulips, right? We don't want just one crop of radicchio. We want a big abundance of that. And we start gardening for maximum production, which also means we're setting the table for maximum pests. So first off, realize you're creating an environment that's encouraging slugs and snails. We also do a lot of what I'd say are dumb things. And this illustration was designed, I sort of feel like we should say, can you find 100 slugs in this picture? Because there's some bad moves in here and some good moves in here, and the text discusses them. the first thing, and I think people do most frequently, is that we've all been told to water our gardens at night. You know, go out at dusk and water, and that way the water will sink into the, we don't have to worry about evaporation, it'll sink into the soil. Well, when you do that, slugs and snails are nocturnal animals that need lots of moisture. It's like bringing out the Zamboni at the hockey game. You're making a perfect environment for slugs and snails. If you start watering your gardens early in the morning when the slugs and snails are knocking off for the evening, for their day of work, that's probably a much better way to go. Just switch your watering regime and be more directed. Don't just water in one, you know, all over the place. Go where the areas where they really need water. Did you have a question?
Yes.
Yeah.
You said they're nocturnal, but they're also cold-blooded. How do they get their heat at night if the sun is not up?
Well, you know, actually, if you watch, it's a good question. If you watch banana slugs, they're walking around in the early morning. That seems to be their thing, too. But by midday, they're done. That's the end of it. So there's a little bit of a stretch there in terms of the cycle. And I suspect they get a lot of warmth from the sun that around sunset. So, good question. Does somebody else have a question, too? All right. The other thing I wanted to point out, a couple of things. There's a compost bin up here. Compost is basically what slugs and snails like to eat, dead stuff. When we throw our compost in there, we're kind of creating a refuge for slugs and snails to get in there, worse yet, lay their eggs, and keep coming out. Every night we think we've got them all, the next morning or the next night there's more slugs and snails, they might be coming from your compost bin. So just moving that far away is going to help in controlling slugs and snails. And then the other thing, there's also a wood pile up in that corner. And, of course, we're creating great hiding places for slugs and snails with those, so move those out of the way. The path that you see in here is a good thing, because slugs and snails don't like to go across gravel paths. Now, conventional wisdom is it's too rough for them. They're crawling on their bellies, right? They don't like that scratchy gravel. But in reality, slugs and snails have no problem going over gravel like this. They have so many muscles in their stomachs, what they call their foot, they could actually go over crushed glass if they want to, just by adjusting all those muscles. And in one experiment, I had read this, I thought I'd better try it myself. I had one of my pet slugs, yes, it's true, I had pet slugs, go over a razor blade. And I was actually thinking, this could be terrible. What if I'm killing my pet? And it got about halfway over the razor blade. I'm holding my breath watching this. It looked up, turned around, and went back over the same blades. It didn't bother it at all to go over a razor blade. What the gravel really does is it dries out faster than the ground around it. And to crawl around and produce all that mucus is a very water-intensive operation. Slugs and snails really need a lot of water. So if there's an area that's really dry, they'd like to avoid it. So having a gravel path like that, that's a good move. Another good move are those raised beds that you see there. Let's jump ahead here. You can take this stuff. This is copper barrier tape. If you put that around pots or around raised beds, it's actually a very thin veneer of copper, which is expensive, on adhesive tape. And when slugs and snails contact this copper barrier tape, copper has a very loose electron in it. That's why we use it for electrical wire, because the electrons aren't held very tightly. When slugs and snails encounter the copper, they get a mild electric shock. Okay, another one, really quickly. There are lots of biological controls. These are guinea fowl. I love this picture Karen drew with a little slug going, "Are you my mother?" But these love to eat slugs and snails. A lot of commercial gardeners have guinea fowl wandering around. You can buy them through the mail. You can get the chicks or even the fertilized eggs delivered to you in the mail. And unlike chickens and ducks, which also like to eat slugs and snails, good thing, they don't scratch as much. They don't go around digging up the dirt and pecking at all the other plants because they're really more looking for higher protein food. So they're much less damaging than a chicken or a duck might be. And some of your kids might know about this, because we were working at Narnia the other day to build insect traps. But the one that we built like this, this is actually a slug trap. And it's basically taking a tub, like a butter tub or Tupperware, with a lid on it, cutting little windows in it, digging it down into the soil, and then you can see, yes, baiting it with beer. What happens is, slugs and snails are really fond, it turns out, of beer, stale beer, and they actually get in there and drown. That's the way I want to go, by the way. Drowning in beer. It turns out it's actually the yeast in the beer that they really like the most. So if you really want to have an effective slug bait, put a little bit of brewer's yeast into that beer and leave it there. Someone at the university in Colorado did a study to look at all the beers and which ones did snails prefer. Isn't that nice what you can get research grants to do? They found out the winner was Kingsbury Malt Beverage. It was a non-alcoholic beer. So they're not going for the buzz. They're going for the yeast, it turns out. Okay, where was I? Okay, just a couple more slides. Someone sent me this picture and wanted to know if this is an albino slug. And actually, it's not. It's just its natural color form. But I like to show this picture because when I give talks like this, I like to pretend that I'm the expert. But I always sense that there are people in the audience who know more than I do. Or certainly gardeners, they get to observe things up close, right? So I encourage you all, if you're interested or you know something that I don't know but should know, or you want to share facts or whatever, please get in touch with me. I'm not one of these secretive writers who wants to hole up in a shack and dial out the rest of the world. I like talking to people online or on the phone or whatever about the things I'm passionate about. And when you try to write a book that's complete, it's never going to be complete. There's always going to be something else that comes out that should be in the next edition. So help me by sharing what you know. And the last picture I'm going to show, sneak preview for tomorrow's presentation. We're going to be talking about insects as the food of the future. These are cockroach canapes. And we're going to be eating some bugs, too. Not cockroaches, but I brought lots of bugs with me just for the Holding Village crowd. So don't miss my talk tomorrow.
Would that be considered vegetarian?
What's that?
Could you consider that vegetarian?
I don't think you can consider insects vegetables. Although we can call it Fish Friday. In a lot of cultures, eating insects started out as a way of, in fact, snails, eating snails. In the monasteries was a way of getting around the prohibition about eating meat on Fridays, or Buddhism about harming living things. Well, we have time for a couple of questions, but I know the lunch bell is going to hit anymore.
Well, you don't have a salt shaker to show as one way to control slugs. Now, are they? But you want to put them in freezers so they don't. They're not feeling any pain.
Okay. Well, here's the thing, because I did actually talk to a slug expert about this very subject. Slugs and snails, they have a lot of nerve endings on the edges of their skin, on the outside of their skin. So when you put salt on them, and everyone's probably tried that at least once, they kind of do like the Wicked Witch of the West and they melt away. But it actually does cause them a lot of pain. Now, pain is a relative thing. How do you measure that in other species? We have a hard enough time. How do you measure pain in humanity? And lawyers make a whole living out of pain and suffering and trying to figure out how many dollars it equals. So I would say the slug experts, just no way are you going to do that. It's going to cause them, the line that the reviewer gave me, which I thought was interesting, exquisite pain when you put salt on slugs. But also, if you start going after every slug in your garden with salt, you're going to wind up with a great salt lake where nothing can grow because there's hundreds and hundreds. The rule of thumb is for every slug or snail that you see, there's at least 10 or 20 that you don't see. So I'm opposed. Yeah.
Okay. Other bad practices. How bad is sluggo? Which is that thing?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, there's actually two different chemical formulas of poisonous slug bait. The old one, I'm trying to think what the actual active ingredient is. It'll come to me when I'm not thinking about it. Is really bad. And there are all these warnings on it. Do not use this stuff near water or where there's wildlife or children or dogs. Dogs eat it and they get really sick. There's a new formula that's been out for several years that's an iron sulfate. And The iron actually is no more harmful than taking iron capsules. I actually saw someone give a demonstration of their product by eating a teaspoon of it. No problem. Now I've got lots of iron in my body. So that's not as harmful. The only problem is it also goes after the native species as well as the non-natives. It can't really distinguish.
And so, speaking of that, if one wanted to use sluggo in one's garden, like, is it possible to actually go out and do a little survey and go like, okay, I mostly have the icky black ones?
Yeah, and actually that's where those, you know, the slug trap I showed earlier, that's probably the real value. You can't kill every, you can't drown every slug in your garden by drinking beer. But you can look in those traps and get an idea, are they the young of the year, or are they big ones, or are they the non-native yucky black ones, or what? And that's really the real value of those kinds of traps. Good question.
We have little white ones in Minnesota, when you dig brown cabbage or potatoes.
Oh, you know, and that's probably the best place to be using the iron sulfate, because those are called milky slugs, and they get into the cabbage, and they live their entire life in there, except for the brief times when you go out, you go to the farmer's market and buy greens. They're living in there too, right? But they actually live their whole life in there, so trapping them, forget that idea. That's not going to work. Or barrier tape or anything. But the iron sulfate, getting them before they get into the crops, is the way to go. Or just living with them, picking them out. Yeah.
Can I ask one other quick question? So are there advantages? I built raised rock beds.
Mm-hmm.
Are there advantages to just the raised bed? Even if, like, I can't get that copper tape to stick to it.
Yeah, I think actually the answer would have to be no, because you're actually creating little refuges. You know, the cracks and crevices maintain their heat. A lot of times you see snails crammed in, lots of them, into an old rock wall, for example. They also hold more moisture, so you're actually kind of encouraging them to some degree. If you have raised beds, you might consider actually just putting another piece of wood around there with the barrier tape on it and see if that does the job for you. The other thing, and Karen always likes to point out this one, a few plants that the slugs and snails really like over in one corner of your garden. Horseradish is a winner.
But give them their own special crop.
That's right. Give them their play area.
Then they get to
and
have
their
own
food.
Play.
And then you can actually go there and monitor populations or
remove
them.
Yeah.
And that might work too.
It's
a decoy. All right, well, thank you all very much.
Thank you.